6 past the hour on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosophers, kings and queens, working class heroes, tops and bottoms of all kinds. It's an embracing, all-encompassing, progressive morning, Mark Riley.
It is?
Ah, why not? I don't know. Sure, yeah, okay.
It's foggy here in New York. I know that.
It was foggy, but it's going to be like 62 degrees, my friend.
Yeah.
Later it's supposed to be. I never know what the hell to wear. Yesterday it was about to snow, and then today I'm like, which jacket should I bring? And, you know, that's
get
how
ready
I
to press the button. The button. Because it's almost halter top weather.
There you go. Yeah, I think we're a little far away from that.
Yeah,
we're still
know.
Far away, man.
I can dream, can I?
Of course you can. Look at this. So the Ohio Supreme Court on Wednesday dismissed a challenge from voters to presidential election in light of last week's certification of the electoral vote and the upcoming inauguration. So now we got to figure out different ways to fight this thing. Now, actually, you know, the real work begins in terms of, you know, infiltrating local governments and changing election boards, right?
And dogging every move that these people make.
Yeah, I mean,
nothing they do should go unchallenged. But there's a very interesting bit of, dare I say, pretzel logic in all this.
We got a bag of pretzels. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, they're now saying that because the election was certified, they have no case anymore. And the whole, you know, basis of the case was to stop the election from being certified. You know,
right.
I mean, it's like, well, okay, they did what they did, so now, you know, there's no case anymore. They don't deal with any of the fundamentals. It's really like a super technical issue.
But that's like a catch-22, isn't it?
Yeah.
You make a case, and then they go against, you know, they certify it, and now they say the case is invalid.
The case is invalid.
It's like a game. It's like a legal game these idiots play.
Well, I wonder how deeply these people are going to investigate this whole Ken Blackwell illegal campaign contribution thing. Blackwell, of course, the Secretary of State of Ohio, who's thinking about running for governor in 2006, sent out a solicitation letter that specifically asked for corporate donations, which are illegal in the state of Ohio. And yet, we trusted this guy, or they trusted this guy, with their election.
Right. It seems like there's obviously a conflict of interest, but they're just going to say that we already, Armstrong Williams is the only black conservative that ever did anything wrong.
That's right.
He's
and,
the scapegoat.
That's right. And Ken Blackwell didn't get 250 G's from Bush. Not yet, anyway.
And look at this. This is ridiculous. I mean, it's important, but it's ridiculous that we have to go this way with this. Two senior Democratic lawmakers asked Wednesday for a congressional investigation into long election day lines. Well, what do you mean?
Yeah,
they didn't put a machine there. There's one machine for 500,000 people. There's these machines that they weren't properly programmed. Some of them were breaking down. Some of them weren't shown how to use them properly. But the basic reason is voter suppression, that there was one machine for too many people.
And, of course,
understaffed.
Serendipity understood. It always seems to happen in the black neighborhood.
Of course.
I don't know why.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't do this to Lithuanians. I guess.
Shifting gears, in an article, scientists who studied the eating patterns of nearly 149,000 American adults over two decades found that those who ate the most red meat and processed meat over a 10-year period of time, 30% higher risk of colon cancer.
All I can say is, I don't eat red meat.
That's not what you're going to die of,
yeah,
Mark Riley.
Baby. No, I'm not. Look, I, and it's not because I had fears about colon cancer. In fact, I'm overdue for a colonoscopy. God help me. But the bottom line here is red meat doesn't help, apparently, especially if you're predisposed to it.
Well, that's ultimately what it comes down to, is genetics.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There are cats that can smoke cigarettes till they're 70. That's always the thing. You know, like I smoked. And I've been smoking too many. I've been smoking those stinky cigars, too.
You've been smoking them?
Yeah, but not, it's weird. You know, when I talk about smoking cigars, like, I don't do anything for, it's not a prestige thing. You know,
You do it in private. You're
exactly.
One of the few cigar smokers that doesn't have anybody else around him when he smokes.
I'm just sitting at home puffing away, playing the blues, trying to memorize my show, eating my fish.
I can see Barrett with a cigar stuck out his mouth, guitar.
That's my life. That's my afternoon. But this, study is important because it really states that those diets that include lots of poultry and fish, 30% less likely to get colon cancer. That's pretty significant. You know, and
that's extremely significant.
I don't eat a lot of, I don't really eat a lot of red meat out of fear. And, it's sort of a treat thing for me.
You put all of the red meat in those black eyed peas you gave to Pashman.
No red meat in that.
No?
It was all turkey? Smoked turkey.
Smoked turkey, cool.
I'll bring you some tomorrow.
Are you sure you're not part black?
I am a little bit.
I You and Randy Rose.
Is she part black, too?
Yeah, she says she is. I mean, you know, the
she
smoked turkey thing. Well, yeah, she
says
on here. But no, yeah, the smoked turkey thing was a revolution in African-American cooking because for years and years, generations, black eyed peas and collard greens were always cooked with pork.
Yeah.
And, you know, somebody got the idea after a while, well, let's try a little smoked turkey.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, now you barely are able to find in a black soul food restaurant black-eyed peas or collard greens that are cooked in pork.
It's a smart thing to do. I mean, I was cooking into those pork shins before.
Yeah.
Well, Pashman, son of Lewis, Dan Pashman, son of Lewis, and Linda Pashman, New Jersey, has got me crocking.
Yeah.
We both have crock pots, and he does a crock pot thing. Now I do a crock pot thing. So I actually went out of my way to go to the 14th Street Green Market, and I picked up that big bag of real pretzels. And I looked for, there's a guy down there, a turkey farm.
Yeah.
Organic turkey farm guy, and he's got these smoked drumsticks. It's the fat content that helps, because if you put a smoked drumstick in, it's got some fat on it.
Yeah.
It's really about the fat, and the smoke flavor is going to come out of anything. I'll bring you some tomorrow, but you don't eat dark turkey meat either.
No, I don't eat. Well, you don't have to eat the meat. See, what's amazing, black-eyed peas are kind of a unique situation. You really do have to cook them in something.
Yeah.
But collard greens, you go to Brazil.
I'm not cooking those with any meat anymore.
Yeah, you can make them without any meat.
Yeah.
Because it's always been such a tradition to have either pork or turkey or whatever in it. The first time I went to Brazil, I said, these can't be collard greens.
Right.
They don't taste like, but they cook them they boil them. And they're wonderful.
I use an organic low-sodium vegetable bouillon as the base for the collard greens. So some onions, some garlic, some hot peppers.
Okay.
And then a little bit. I finish it off with a little lemon or some vinegar. That makes it pretty traditional when you throw the vinegar on there. Dig this. What do you think of this? He's getting his in before the tort reform kicks in. The restricting victims' rights. Well, here's...
Only in America!
Why don't they use this as an example of lawsuits that are frivolous? Boxing promoter Don King filed a defamation suit Wednesday, claiming he was portrayed in a false light in an ESPN Sports Century segment aired last May, and his attorney said King is entitled to damages of more than $2.5
billion. Not million, ladies and gentlemen. Billion.
What is that?
Dollars.
That's crazy.
And now,
he's crazy.
Know, during the Republican convention, Mark, I was at that diner on right here in Midtown Manhattan when I did the segment with Armstrong Williams. Guess who was on before me? Shilling for Bush.
Exactly. In his
Don King.
Two flags waving.
Two
for
flags
Bush.
Waving.
This is a great example. Why don't they use him, you know, as an example of a frivolous lawsuit?
Gee, Don, is only a quarter of a million of that pain and suffering? Like Bush wants?
This is just the ECC. He's a press whore, this guy.
No, let me tell you something.
What?
He's got Willie Gary representing.
Yeah, but still, I mean,
Willie Gary ain't no joke.
But come on, $2.5 billion. What could they have said about that? Like, how could they have made him look any worse than he already is?
What Don will do is settle this for some pocket change that he can use to pay off somebody that's suing him. That's all this is. He knows he's not getting $2.5 billion. He'd have to exhume Walt Disney to get $2.5 billion out of these people.
$2.5 billion.
But, yeah, you know, aim high. That's what he's always done.
You know what I did last night, man? I for some reason, every time The Last Samurai is on television, I got to sit through the whole damn thing.
I heard about this. You watched it, huh?
The whole damn thing. Twice. I've watched it like three times. I saw it in the movies, too. Like, I'm no huge Tom Cruise fan, but there's something about that movie. For some reason, I wanted to see it. And my wife and I went to see it. And, you know, it's schlocky on some level, but there's some pretty amazing fight scenes in it, and it's a pretty good story, and the guy who plays the samurai, the samurai leader, is brilliant in it, and even Cruise is okay, but the weird thing is like, it's one of those movies where it's got this tone, you know, and you know the fight scenes are coming up, and you know there's sort of some justice at the end, you know, even though out of the entire death of the samurai, this horrendous bloody battle where all the last of the samurai gets killed, and you know, it's got to be, you know, a white guy, Tom Cruise, who of course lives to tell the story, but there is something about it. It's the same dude who directed Glory. And you remember those Civil War fight scenes in that movie?
Oh, yeah, that was great.
He's great. at choreographing fight scenes. But I've watched it so many times now that I'm starting to want to learn more about the real story, which is good. If a movie that's relatively schlocky can provoke you to be interested in the real thing, then
that is so much better. Have you ever watched the original Seven Samurai?
Of course.
Toshiro Mifune?
Of course. But there's something about the history of the samurai now that interests me, because apparently there is some truth to the story about how the last of the samurai were done away with, and the political dynamics in Japan at the time. In the movie, they really captured as the emperor had become sort of like powerless and was being bullied by war ministers and trade ministers to modernize Japan and get rid of this old style loyalty to the people and to the samurai protecting the people at the behest of the emperor. So they were literally taken out by the Japanese army that were fueled by German guns and just destroyed the great tribal legacy of the samurai in this historic...
Was this the beginning of World War II?
It sounds a lot like it.
No, it looked like it was towards the end of the Civil War.
Yeah.
But, you know, I like movies that deal with that. I like Westerns that deal with the oncoming, you know, like Sam Peckinpah did a couple movies like that in The Wild Bunch, where the Mexican government got hold of the German guns, and it just sort of changed the face of any sort of power dynamic in the West and in the world.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
cards as well.
And there's a lot of that stuff that really is hidden history as far as Americans are concerned. You know, Mexicans know about it. Other people in other parts of the world know about it. But America, you know, the whole thing about Pancho Villa, man, that's some fascinating stuff, too. Somebody was trying to do a movie about him.
They did it on HBO, too, a movie about him being in the movies. But we got to talk about the issues here at some point. We're going to talk about this. Some interesting stuff going on in Atlanta, Georgia, in relation to some same-sex marriage topics.
Yeah. Atlanta's a very different place compared to the rest of the South. But,
this is a devious way that the small-town lawmakers are trying to get around this.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And here we go. We'll be back in a second at 17 past the hour on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on the air and online at morningsedition.com from Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here on Morning Sedition with Mark Riley.
Yes.
Air America Radio. Hey, look, you know, this is a roundabout way to get at this law. Am I wrong, Mark Riley?
No, you're not.
In Atlanta, which has a large, large gay community.
One of the largest in the country.
12,000 same-sex households, the fourth highest concentration of gay couples among Americans' big cities after San Francisco, Seattle, and Oakland, California. Now, apparently what's happening here, this case is being built, that there is some movement in the local legislature, not newly Republican, but very Republican.
Yeah. This is about a very specific set of circumstances, Mark. It has to do with, of all things, membership in a golf club. That's where all of this starts, okay? Because two people who are gay, one is a lesbian, one is a gay man, wanted to extend the privileges of this golf club to their partners who were of the same sex.
Right, and now this golf club, to their benefit, you know, because Atlanta is a sophisticated, urbane, you know, open-minded, liberal bastion of the South, is not, you know, this club is not against having gay members, and they allow gay members.
They allow gay members, and, you know, you got to pay 40 long to belong to this thing anyway. So, you know, it's not cheap. You're not talking about the local municipal course full of divots and whatnot. This is an expensive spot.
Okay.
Now, the club is saying, no, we are not going to, we don't want to extend those benefits. The problem is that Atlanta passed an ordinance that said they had to, and that they were in violation of the law, of local law, if they did not.
So Atlanta passed an ordinance supporting gay civic unions as being legal.
Not really.
Oh.
What they said was, you have to extend those benefits to these partners. Okay.
Right.
In other words, if you extend the benefits to, now, on that level, I guess that's true. Because if you extend these benefits, for example, to someone's wife who's heterosexual, then you have to extend these benefits to a same-sex partner in a similar fashion.
So this is the way people in support of same-sex unions have to chip away at the legal system, is to get these type of rights, where civil unions, whether or not they're addressed or not, if they can get the rights for people who are in gay couples, in gay households, to get the rights of people who are married, then that's a start. So now you have these new Republican legislators who are going to start to chip away at the other way.
Yeah, they have submitted a bill that would repeal that part of Atlanta's city ordinance. In other words, they are superseding the local government. This is what you risk when you are a blue city in a red state.
Right.
Okay? And the legislature is saying, well, the golf club should, in fact, have the right to discriminate. It's part of their First Amendment rights.
Right.
So that's where they are with this. And, of course, the gay community and people in Atlanta generally are saying, wait a minute, man, this is a municipal issue. You know, if you want to be able to discriminate, well, move out of Atlanta, that's all.
All right, this is Representative Earl Earhart.
Yeah.
He's a Powder Springs Republican and the incoming chairman of the House Rules Committee.
Yeah, that's the Georgia House, not the federal House, thank God.
But it's just very interesting to me that this is one of those great examples where, hey, look, you know, we live here in Atlanta. No one's bothering anybody here. We're trying to live life in a free way, in an open-minded way. Mm-hmm. And you know, podunk idiots are trying to impose your morality on us. Because why? Because why?
See, this is, Mark, the problem that Atlanta, that Georgia has with Atlanta is similar to, in some ways, to the problem other states have with their large cities. Atlanta really has, I mean, Maynard Jackson, the late Maynard Jackson, who was the mayor of Atlanta, the first black mayor of Atlanta, he passed a gay pride ordinance way back in the 1970s when it was, in fact, dangerous for a black guy to even, you know, run for mayor, much less do this.
I'm sure he understood that this is really a human rights issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, above all else, this is a human rights issue. This is a civil rights issue.
Yeah, and each successive Atlanta mayor, Andy Young and the current mayor, Mayor Franklin, have all, you know, I mean, the gay constituency in Atlanta is an important part of their constituency. And what you're seeing happen now is and a lot of this is boldness in the wake of the election.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Where people say, well, hey, you know, Bush gave us a mandate. We got moral values on our side. Let's go make these Atlantans back up a little bit.
Yeah, we'll talk about that mandate when we talk about Ted Kennedy's speech after this break in a minute. But like here, even in the language, you know, Earhart, Representative Earhart, the bill is to give organizations the right to deny benefits mm-hmm. to couples. See, right there, it is the right to deny rights.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, and that's really what's at the crux of this issue, is the right to deny rights to people.
It is the right to deny across the board. That's what the Bush administration, that's what these Republicans are really all about. And you're talking about denying Medicaid benefits or denying same-sex benefits. It's all about denial. You're right.
Fuming, what they do is they fuel fear. They deny rights. They create crises and realities that aren't there to get what they want. And you know, and Kennedy yesterday, Ted Kennedy, really addressed some of this stuff. And I'm excited. We got some sound from him after this. We're going to talk about some of the stuff he was saying about the Democratic Party and where it needs to go.
Yeah, and he came up with some strong stuff. We've also got the liberal agenda and much, much more for you here on Air America Radio.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley, Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Get ready for the wildest comedy of the summer. It's Donald Rumsfeld's Abu Ghraib and Animal House. Starring Lindy England. Charles Grainer.
You can't do that to our pledges. Only we can do that to our pledges.
Chip Frederick.
Now, we have an old saying in Delta. Don't get mad. Get even.
And Donald Rumsfeld as Dean Wormer.
Fat, drunk, and stupid is no way to go through life.
It's the slob versus the snob in this hilarious prison romp. Donald Rumsfeld, Abu Ghraib, Animal House. You'll laugh till it hurts.
Thank you, sir. May I have another? Thank you, sir. May I have another?
Why? Why? You're asking why? Why?
Yes.
Why do we have to hear that again? Why? Well, because Army Specialist Charles Grainer, apparently, according to a Syrian insurgent held at Abu Ghraib prison, and this is during his a testimony, said that Grainer merrily whistled, sang, and laughed while brutalizing him, and forced him to eat pork and drink alcohol in violation of his Muslim faith. And I guess in honor of that, that's why Ramon shows up. Looking pretty badly beaten, actually,
wow.
With Charles Grainer's Palm Pilot for today during the trial. I'm assuming this is where it's going on. Here's Charles Grainer's schedule. 7 a.m., wake up, masturbate, before the jailer forces me to masturbate. See, I win again.
Okay.
8 a.m., call Lindy, make sure the baby is leashed. 9 a.m., meet with lawyer before court-martial trial. Now that man disturbs me. Comparing prison abuse to cheerleading? Sick. Venal. 9:30 a.m., discuss strategy with lawyer. When Muslim prisoners accuse me of forcing them to eat pork and drink alcohol, reply that, back home, we call that breakfast. 1 p.m., court-martial trial. Remember, don't stack pencils. 3 p.m., watch abuse videos. tell the court, in my defense, these were much funnier with the sound effects.
Oh, God.
7 p.m., back in cell, masturbate. They'll never break me. I know the drill. That is Grainer's Palm Pilot for today.
Oof.
It's getting exciting, huh?
Yeah.
All right, so look at this. Ted Kennedy. Wow. He got excited. Bonked that mic stand.
That's funny.
I don't know if people ever notice that when I do that, but it's like literally this mic stand could become a musical instrument.
There's springs in it,
so when you hit it, it's like, whing.
And it like stays out in the ether for like seconds.
It does. Like, what are those things called? A dirigible?
Didgeridoo.
Didgeridoo. I love watching guys play that.
For those of you who don't live in New York, we got guys in the train that play those things.
There's some guys that play some wild instruments in the train. That dude that plays the Senegal, that harp-looking thing.
Oh, man. I should know the name of it.
Those things are beautiful. And to see somebody play an instrument you've never seen before and it's just mind-blowing.
Well, yeah, it's just like some of them, unfortunately, come with these really exotic instruments, and then they play the most insipid music.
Oh, yeah. They think they're trying to be American. Yeah, I want to do something they'll like. You know, here's a Phil Collins song played on the didgeridoo.
Or Valari. On a saw.
I'd rather they play anything than see that guy who dances with the doll to Latino music.
That's him. He makes a fortune, that guy.
I know, but it's horrendous.
Of course it's horrendous. Think of how the doll feels.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is, the guy makes good money. I see him all over the subway system.
Do you remember the dude who used to get on the trains and just, he'd blast like horrendous, like almost like Ornette, like what his interpretation of Ornette Coleman was is some Coltrane, but it was like it was just him on an alto sax playing really loud, and he would get on the train just like and people just be like, geez, what the hell's going on? Because he was blasting it as if he were playing a solo in front of a jazz combo, right? But it'd get to the point where people, it was genius, they'd give him money to stop.
Well, that was the whole point.
Exactly. It's $5, dude. Take me the next car.
Yeah. Well, anyway. Hi, suckers.
Blah, that boobie, bah! All right, so moving on.
Yeah.
Ted Kennedy, all of a sudden woke up and spoke. Let's hear that, Chris. Let's hear a bit of what Kennedy said at the address at the National Press Club on Wednesday.
We have an administration that falsely hypes almost every issue as a crisis. They did it on Iraq, and they are doing it now on Social Security. They exploit the politics of fear and division, while ours is a politics of hope and unity. In the face of their tactics, we cannot move our party or our nation forward under the pale colors and timid voices. If we do, we will lose again and deserve to lose. As I have said on other occasions, the last thing our country needs is two Republican parties.
See, isn't that great? He's full of the fire. I like when he gets full of the fire because he's got that tenor. He's got that great Kennedy timbre to his voice.
Yeah. But now here's the question.
Yes, sir.
You really kind of got to put your money where your mouth is. Who's he backing for DNC chair? That'll tell you where he's really coming from.
I wonder who he is backing.
I don't know that he's backing Dean. Well, he may back Dean. He may back Martin Frost, like our friend Barney Frank is.
Sure.
From Barney Frank. You know, these guys are now, this is starting to get serious because they're going to be naming the new DNC chair or electing the new DNC chair next month.
Just as long as Terry McAuliffe isn't there, I'll be happy.
I don't know what people were thinking. You know, Bill Richardson, a guy from your home state, your homie, the governor of New Mexico.
I like that guy.
He was in charge of the forces that wanted Terry McAuliffe to stay.
Well, okay, I don't like him anymore. See how easy that was?
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about this, because this is what Ted Kennedy is doing and what some of the Democrats are doing, the ones that have a spine, are trying to move away from this idea that we must move towards this mythical center. And the myth, and this is, I'm sort of paraphrasing a David Sirota piece in The Nation from December 16th. Here's the myth. By attacking President Bush and the Republicans for siding with super wealthy Democrats are waging class warfare, which will hurt Democrats at the ballot box. The fact, in March 2004, a Washington Post poll found a whopping 67% of Americans believe the Bush administration favors large corporations over the middle class. An NBC poll on Election Day 2004 found that 55% of voters believe the same thing. The myth, if Democrats hammer corporations for their misbehavior and push for a serious crackdown on corporate excess, the party will be hurt by an anti-business image. That's just crazy to begin with.
I know.
The fact that 2002 Washington Post poll taken during the height of the corporate accounting scandals found that 88% of Americans distrust corporate executives, 90% want new corporate regulations / tougher enforcement of existing laws, and more than half think that the Bush administration, the neocon death cult, is not tough enough in fighting corporate crime.
Now, see, this is he's onto something there, because the fact is that there have been so many Americans who have been shafted by corporations that would close down and move overseas because they can pay people 3 cents a day or whatever it is they don't have to pay. Corporations that balkanize their relationship between the executives and the workforce by paying the executive 500 times what they pay the average worker. All of this stuff is fodder for the Democratic Party. It's good to see that people are now starting to say, okay, we just have to fashion a way to get this message to people. Because right now, I mean, it's almost as though people believe, well, you know, Bush is our guy. Bush is the president. I guess we got to stick with him. Which is really so sick.
It's crazy. And now they're taking the hit, on health care, because some corporations are cutting, you know, what they're going to provide health care for.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It's really leaving a lot of people out in the lurch. And, you know, in Kennedy, there's some more highlights from Kennedy's speech. We don't have we've got it here on paper, like, quote, our highest priority must be a world-class education for every American.
Yep.
That's a Democratic ideal. Every eighth grader can sign a contract saying if they work hard, finish high school, and enter college, they will be guaranteed the cost of earning a degree. Not a bad idea. Quote, here's another quote from Kennedy. More than half of all graduate students in science and engineering in American colleges today are foreign students, all right? So make tuition for graduate schools in these disciplines free for needy students. Make undergraduate education free for any student willing to teach math or science in public school for at least 4 years. That's a great idea. Pay for all this by allowing colleges to negotiate better deals with student loan providers. I mean, be the reasonable, progressive ideas of trying to help people.
Be proactive. He's also talking about expanding Medicare, something that the Bush administration considers to be heresy. He wants to expand Medicare to cover everybody that needs health care.
But I like the focus on education and the focus on jobs is really an amazing thing that Kennedy's, you know, bringing into focus. We all focus on it somewhat,
yeah.
But it's nice to hear somebody with some integrity, and he does have integrity. You know, I don't care what anybody says about Ted Kennedy, whatever his reputation is, the dude will get up and shoot one off there occasionally, and you'll just go, wow. Look at that. Listen to that, dude. Well, here, what America wants, what a progressive economy works for, job flexibility with time for family, volunteering, children's education, jobs that pay fairly without forcing excessive hours, safe workplaces and the right to join forces with fellow workers, discrimination-free workplaces, at least 7 days of paid sick leave per year, new tax benefits for companies that create good jobs with good benefits, raising the federal minimum wage, greater education and prosperity for women, reducing numbers, But the thing is that if this is all true, you know, if this can be done, you know, it would be an amazing thing. It's just facilitating this because this is so antithetical to what the Republicans stand for.
Well, this is the Democrats' challenge. They have got to package this and sell it to the American people. It can be done. This is the richest nation in the world. If we can go over and invade a country 6,000 miles from here, however far away Iraq is, we can do all these things. We can provide Medicaid. We can give kids a good education through college. We can do all of this stuff.
Not as opposed to, you know, getting the economy reinvigorated by cutting social programs, by privatizing, you know, government-guaranteed retirement funds, by, you know, they've got the wrong idea on how to get the economy going.
But, well, see, and the other thing is, Mark, if Kennedy can lay this sort of thing out, this is, in fact, an ownership society. It's just not the ownership society Bush is talking
about. It's a self-ownership society in the sense that if he can lay this stuff out, if we can activate these principles, people will feel better about themselves. And believe me, it's not some sort of New Age hokum that stuff, you know, it kind of, you know, it flows through the culture. If people feel good about what they're doing and about what they're getting and that justice is being served, it will resonate.
You mean like in the 90s? Because that's when it happened.
Yeah.
That's when Americans began to say, you know what, I'm paying my rent, I'm able to send my kids off to school, I'm doing the things, the basic things that most Americans have in common that they want.
I like having this job, it makes me feel good. 46 past the hour, we'll be back after this on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Yes, hello, Mark.
How are you?
I'm all right. We're going to do this new thing now. My buddy Sam Lipside's new book comes out. Sam Lipside, I believe, is one of the great inspired novelists of his time. He writes a dark type of comic novel popularized, you know, a lot in the 70s with Stanley Elkin, Joseph Heller, mm-hmm. You know, he, Barry Hanna. He, you know, this guy is the real deal. He's a great writer, and his new book is called Homeland. And this is the inaugural book in the Morning's Edition Book Club. We're hoping you'll read these books, and then we'll have the authors on the program to talk with you about what you've read. You can get more details at morningsedition.com, or you can also purchase Homeland, which is out in this country this month, and Sam's going to be with us tomorrow. Homeland is a series of letters. This is fiction, but it's a series of letters written by a somewhat bitter man named Lewis Minor. It's 15 years after high school, and he's writing these letters to the Eastern Valley High School Alumni Bulletin, knowing that they're not going to ever see the light of day. Now, you'll hear Sam refer to catamounts in this piece that we're about to play, which is the mascot of the Eastern Valley High. Again, this is Sam Lipsyte from his novel, Homeland.
It's confession time, catamounts. It's time you knew the cold, soft facts of me. Ever since Principal Fontana found me and commenced to bless my mail slot monthly with the Eastern Valley High School alumni newsletter, I've been meaning to write my update. Sad to say, vanity slowed my hand. Let a fever for the truth speed it now. Let me stand on the rooftop of my reckoning and shout naught but the indisputable. I did not pan out. We've got catamount doctors, after all. Catamount lawyers, brokers, bankers, well-versed in the Eastern Valley purr. Okay, maybe it was never quite a purr. Maybe more a surly mule. But answer me this. Why did we fail so miserably to name this noise with which we spurred our sporting types to conquest? Moreover, why was the mascot of Eastern Valley an animal that prefers elevation? A catamount is a mountain cat, catamounts. We've got a state senator, a government chemist, a gold glove ball player, not to mention, according to the latest issue of Catamount Notes, a major label recording artist in our midst. Yes, fellow alums, we're boasting bright lights aplenty these days, serious comers, future leaders in their fields. Hell, we've even got a fellow who double majored in philosophy and aquatic life management in college, and still found time for a national squash title. Think about it, catamounts. We didn't have squash at Eastern Valley. We didn't have tennis either, unless you count that trick with the steel hairbrush and the catgut racket whereby the butt skin of the weak was flayed. Point being, this boy, Will Paulson, may he rest in peace, left our New Jersey burg without the faintest notion of squash, yet mastered it enough to beat the pants off every prep school biff in the land, and still carry a 4.0 in the question of why does the universe exist underwater? Is this what Principal Fontana meant by the phrase well-rounded? It's f***ing spherical, catamounts. Alas, my meager accomplishments appear pale, if not downright pasty, in comparison. I shudder at the notion of Dr. Stacy Rison and State Senator Glenn Menninger remarking on this update at some fundraising soiree. Oh, the snickers, the chortles, the wine-flushed glances, and later, perhaps, the puppyish sucking of body parts at a nearby motor lodge. Shudder, in fact, is not quite the word for the feeling. Feeling is not quite the word for the feeling. How's bathing at knife point in the phlegm of the dead? Is that a feeling?
Yes. Ooh. Yes, Sam Lipsyte will be on the show tomorrow. One of the great purveyors of truly dark comedy. I mean, I got to be honest with you. Now, and I know this guy, you know, and he's a friend of mine. But I'll tell you, there are segments in this book. There's nothing better than reading a book and actually being, you know, thrown into a fit of laughter, like convulsive laughter. I love seeing people have that experience. I love, like, when you're on the train and you watch somebody reading, it's such a personal thing. You almost feel like a voyeur watching somebody laughing while they're reading a book. You don't want to be, well, I feel like a voyeur a lot on the train because I tend to lock down and just stare at people. Do you do that ever, Riley? You don't ride the train.
No, I'm one of the people that I used to think everybody was staring at me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'm not one of those people. I tend to sort of like lock in. You know, I'm looking forward to our guest later in the show today. We've got this guy, Malcolm Gladwell. He's the author of this book, Blink. And it's called The Power of Thinking Without Thinking. His whole book is about those momentary, impulsive reactions and opinions that we have right when we engage with something. And how many of them, most of the time, like, as high as 90% of the time, are valid.
I know, but I can't do that, Aaron. But we'll discuss that with him.
I can't do it, but I have also found that a lot of times I'm wrong. But he's going to put it into a psychological context, into a biological context. He's got points. It's fascinating stuff. You know, because he talks about the animal response that we have.
Can he put it in the context of seething, boiling evil?
Of course.
Oh, okay. Well, then we can talk.
That's what a lot of people have that immediate reaction.
Really?
Yeah.
But see, I've always had a governor that hasn't allowed me to kind of express. I sort of think it to myself, and then I move on.
Well, that's great, Riley. You're civilized.
I try.
A lot of times I'll just blast one off.
I grew up with guys like you. I mean, most of the guys I came up with were guys that would blast off at the slightest period. If they met you and they didn't like it, say, hey, I don't like your face, man.
Well, no, I don't do that. I usually, when I blast off, it's because, you know, I've overcompressed somehow, and it's not like direct reaction to events. It's more like, you know, I'm an ass, you know, and I start screaming and throwing things around and making a big scene, but not at somebody necessarily. Here's a little agenda from the Streisand compound. One, no. Now that Kid Rock's been dropped from Bush's inauguration, reclassify him from GOP hack to just hack. Two, if Angelina Jolie really did break up Brad Pitt's marriage by co-starring in a movie with him, make sure her next movie is with Bush and Karl Rove. That would be good. There you go. Cast Michael Powell. Three, cast Michael Powell to appear on a live new version of This Old House so that when he accidentally hits his thumb with a hammer, he'll say, and have to find himself. Four, now that the search for WMDs is officially over, send the White House this letter. Told ya, love Hans Blix. Five, phrase of the day, just drop it into conversation. You know why the trade deficit is at $60 billion last month? Because the only thing we manufacture in this country is excuses to kill Muslims. Wake up, sheeple. Bush took your rent money, man.
Ooh.
I can't read, sheeple. Help me out. What do we got coming up now?
Well, in the next hour, we're going to, as we usually do, explore your dreams. And we've got a certain very special guest. We're not going to tell you who it is. You got to keep listening to Morning's Edition here on Air America Radio.
Maron, you're listening to Air America Radio at 6 past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, temporary Buddhas, yoga folks. How are you all? I feel like I need to go back to yoga. My brother's become like some yoga fanatic, Riley.
The Republican?
He's not a Republican. That's Kent's brother.
Oh, that's Kent's brother.
My brother's just my brother. He's, I don't know what, I assume his political affiliation is Democrat, but he's a, you know, he's pretty much a self-absorbed kind of guy.
And he's doing yoga now?
Like compulsively, I think. He's like he's got the full-on clarity. You know, some people, you do yoga enough, you just zap into another mode of existence.
My wife's trying to talk me into doing some yoga classes. I'm not sure. I'd never get into all that esoteric
stuff. I'd love to see that.
Yeah, right. No, I'd like to be able to put my leg over my shoulder. Why not?
Yeah, why not? Just to show that you can on a bet.
Yeah.
I bet you can't do that. Yeah.
Never mind. Don't press the button.
All right, no button pressing. Sorry about the mic movement there. Yeah, I don't know. I just did it as exercise. I couldn't get into the whole meditation element of it. But eventually, if you do enough of it and you do it right, you can't help it. You just snap into this different mode.
Yeah.
Do this, man. Two private U.S. companies have designs on building the first luxury recreational vehicle that could withstand nuclear radiation, Riley.
Ooh.
Nuclear radiation. Parliament Coast Corporation and privately held company in Clearwater, Florida, which converts Prevost buses into high-end RVs, has partnered with Homeland Defense Vehicles to offer consumers a luxury motor coach that can protect occupants against nuclear radiation from dirty bombs, as well as biological and chemical effects. Well, I'm glad these are now available to American consumers. Maybe they should make them available to the soldiers.
Is that the spokesman for those combined companies, Tom Ridge, former National Security Director?
He's probably going to be selling them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He'll probably be at the showroom. Hey, aren't
Come
you
on down!
You? But isn't this unbelievable? This is like, you know, many people, this is a quote from the executive from Parliament chief or Parliament, Parliament coach. Many people enjoy the RV lifestyle, but we also live in an era when people have some level of fear about terrorism. But they're going to market these like the Hummers. I mean, these are things, they're actually building these things so you can live in them for 3 or 4 days without ever getting out, sealed in a non-radioactive environment.
Well, I mean, you know, we really haven't seen that many terrorist attacks in the places where they have all those big RVs like Montana and Wyoming and Idaho and places like that. Those are the places where people sell those big oversized RVs. Oh, Florida. I mean, you know, here in New York, you don't see those things every day unless there's a movie shoot going on somewhere.
I never see an RV.
Oh, I see them. On the street. That's about the only place you see them.
You know how much these babies are going for? $1.1 million to $1.9 million, including a trailer. It's nice they throw in the trailer.
Is that with or without a rocket-propelled grenade?
I guess that's later. That's the kind of stuff you're going to have to order on your own. Those are the accessories, right? The extras.
Yeah,
that's hilarious.
1.1, a mere bag of shells to be safe.
And for the, let's see, what does it say, $100,000... the filtration system, which uses positive air pressure, a water filtration system, I guess, will be an option costing about $100,000. So this is unbelievable that, you know,
I'm buying a Brita. Never mind that. Britas are what, 20 bucks?
Bound to happen, you know. That, you know, that this is just how, you know, the fear thing, you know, trickles into the world of capitalism and into the economy in the way of products that, you know, here you go.
Well, yeah, now, because people will always try and profit from people's fear. I give you as an example, our president, George W. Bush.
That's all he does.
Yeah!
It's a Social Security crisis, kids. You're going to retire and not have any money. You're going to just be living alone on the street eating dog food.
Yeah, and I'll be old and collecting mine and saying, nyeh, 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 nyeh.
Yeah.
You know, that's the crisis we got.
That's a tactic of the neocon death cult.
It's sick.
Promoting fear.
It is absolutely sick. And the strange thing is, when he was criticized about all this stuff during the campaign, he accused Kerry of using scare tactics. Oh, you're trying to scare the seniors. Well, what are you doing? What are you doing, fool?
I just want to remind people, if you live in the Boston area, I will be performing at Jimmy Tingle's Off-Broadway Theater in Davis Square, Somerville, Massachusetts. That's next Friday and Saturday, January 21st and 22nd. You can go to the tour dates page on morningsedition.com for info and tickets. If you'd like to contact your senator to oppose Alberto Gonzalez and learn more about veterans opposing Gonzalez, you can go to the links page on Morning Sedition. Refuse to surrender your freedom. Sign the ACLU's pledge by going to the links page on morningsedition.com if you want to blog with the bloggers.
Oh, yeah.
Good morning to you all. Have not checked in lately, but I hope you're doing well and having fun. That's morningsedition.com. There's a blog. You can go there, and there's also Sedition at Air America Radio if you want to email.
So you're going back up to Somerville?
Because, you know, occasionally, Mark, I will respond to an email or two.
Oh, yes, you will. Especially the negative ones.
Well, you know, I think some people have decided, like, we can push this guy's buttons. So they'll actually write me.
They'll push your buttons, and then they'll duck, because you'll push right back.
Yeah, they like it.
But,
they
you
like
know, this Jimmy Tingle thing, I have to tell you, the trip we made up to Boston was probably the best time I've had in Boston in 30-something years, number one.
Yep.
Plus, I thought we did some really good radio up there. I'd love to go back.
Yeah, I think we will go back.
And, you know, the fact that you're going back up there reinforces the fact they love you up there, man.
Well, you know, it's weird because I spent 7 years of my life in Boston, and I lived there for a long time. I was very engaged with the city. You know, I considered it my home. And then there was just this period where I just haven't gone back. And going back with the show is great because it reengaged me with this whole world that I hadn't been to in a long time. I'm looking forward to it. Jimmy Tingle I've known for years.
Yeah.
The theater's a sweet little place. It's got a seat, maybe 200 people. It's a nice, tight little room, and I'm looking forward to working through some new stuff and getting some stuff out there and performing. I like to perform in a theater. I there might even be the chance. I got to take Jerusalem.
Don't tell people what it is. Right? Make it a surprise. Say, I might do something a little different.
There you go. I might do something different that I haven't done in a few years up there. I know one night I'm going to just jam on some stand-up, and then another night I'm doing a show in Poway, San Diego, outside of San Diego, the Poway Center for the Performing Arts in February. I'll be performing my one-man show, Jerusalem Syndrome, that I'm getting back up on its feet.
Yeah.
And it's exciting because I actually had this thing that's a script, you know, and I worked from the script. I did it hundreds of times, but reprogramming the brain, it's pretty interesting how much of it is all sitting up there. Not just because it's my memories, but because it's there. There's a template for it in my head. It's already been programmed in. I just have to feed the information back into it, and it just locks down. It's really kind of cool. So I'm sitting there ranting and raving in my apartment with my guitar, smoking cigars, talking to my cats, eating fish, and doing my one-man show for my cats. They're all sitting on the couch, and I'm like, don't you get it, man? They're like,
good cigar? Were you smoking a good one?
No, you know, I just smoked those stinky little punch. Those J&R's Rothschilds.
Oh, the Rothschilds. Those aren't stinky. Those are decent cigars.
I smoke old man cigars. I think I'm going to evolve into a
strange old man. No, old man cigars are like Ginobili's and stuff like that.
Well, I think we should talk about something important.
We've got Kid Rock?
Kid Rock is out, apparently. Apparently he was never in.
That's a lie.
You think?
They were lying like rugs. They had booked the guy.
Well, apparently there were some lyrics in one of his songs that actually took a shot at Barbara Bush.
Barbara Bush, yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, this guy's lyrics define the word misogynist, all right? Pimp of the nation, wax that booty. Just all over the place with this foolishness. And,
there will be no booty waxing.
No booty waxing at Bush's inaugural.
I mean, booty waxing is foolishness if I ever heard it.
But you know what? I'm going to have to do something. Now, my daughter is a Hillary Duff fan. And Hillary Duff, that trollop, is performing at the Bush Young People's Inaugural. I guess they replaced Kid Rock with her. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
But now I have to get my daughter to rethink whether or not she's actually going to support Hillary Duff with her because she's got a Hillary Duff poster in her bedroom, I think.
Yeah, she's the songstress of the neocon death cult youth movement.
And you know, this thing is hosted by the Bush twins, which means there'll be plenty of liquor there for people to get.
There you go.
Here, have a shot. I don't care how old you are.
You can be all boozed up. Hillary Duff's all boozed. Dancing around with their tops off. That would be beautiful, man.
Wow, man.
Wow, man. I think we're going to have to ride this train over to the next segment.
Oh.
15 past the hour. We'll be back in a second on Air America Radio.
Hello, this is Mick Foley, professional wrestler and best-selling author, and you're listening to the two guys who give the right wing the smackdown. It's Mark Maron and Mark Riley with Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Today's the day, Mark Riley.
Yeah.
19 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm Mark Maron. That's my buddy Mark Riley, as I just said, and I'm going to therapy today. I had a breakthrough last week.
Yeah.
Very happy about it. I mean, a lot of people are like, therapy, who the hell needs therapy? I'm telling you, if you need it, you need it. If you don't, you don't. It's wild when something good happens. You're like, oh, look, a key to me has been given to me.
Ooh.
Well, here we go. This is my dream diary from last night, and it's appropriate. So I'm at therapy, and I'm lying down on an enormous couch made out of chocolate. Whizzing around the couch are monkeys in top hats riding their tricycles and shooting off bottle rockets. My therapist's huge face looms over me and says, tell me about your dream diaries, Mark. And I say, okay, well, I had this one where I was being dunked in a vat of gold underneath the Capitol building. My therapist nods and says, go on, as he takes out a black magic marker and begins drawing a dotted line around my skull. This makes me a little nervous, so I break a chunk of chocolate off the couch and rub it all over my face. I say, okay, then I had one where my dead cat Butch was a matador and she was tormenting Alberto Gonzalez in a bull ring. My therapist nods again, then pulls the cord on a chainsaw and begins cutting along the dotted line of my skull. Bits of hair and bone and brain and blood start flying everywhere while he's cutting. He yells, and how did that make you feel? Over the whine of the chainsaw, I yell, I don't know, nervous? Disoriented? He shuts it off and then peels back my skull to reveal my naked brain. Licking his lips, he asks, so do you think you are transferring your frustrations to Butch? As he takes out a bottle of habanero's hot sauce and pours it all over my brain, which feels kind of good, I gotta be honest, which is, he takes out a spoon and begins eating my brain and makes loud slurping noises. I say, why would I express my frustrations to my cat? Then the monkeys start shrieking because they want some fresh brain too. And he says, I don't know, why would you express your frustrations to a dead cat? Then the monkeys pelt him with their feces until he throws them a few chunks of cerebellum just before I pass out from not having any brains left. I say, because my subconscious knows certain truths that my waking state denies. My therapist wiped some brain off the corner of his mouth, belched loudly, and said, come back next week and we'll discuss this some more. I think we're making a lot of progress. I woke up and my bed was filled with serotonin.
Ooh.
Now, that was some deep dreaming, my friend.
But you know what? You got off easy.
I did.
Yeah, because he didn't say, that'll be how many dollars?
You know, that always happens eventually. It's weird. I don't pay them, right away. I don't pay them right away. I usually end up waiting a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
So, Eventually it builds up, and all of a sudden he goes, you owe me $900. I'm like, that can't be.
Yeah, right.
We're just talking. That's the weirdest thing. Here's the weirdest thing about my therapist, all right? He's a good cat. You know, he's helped me a lot. Don't need to mention any names. But so much of my problems, you know, so much, you know, for a while there, it's pretty specific. It's like, you know, okay, my wife's over there. I got to get up real early. Here's what's going on at the job. And because of the job, like, sometimes we'll just get into political discussions. Right, we'll just be sitting there like during the election campaign and stuff, and we'll just be like, well, "What do you think? What do you think's going on with Kerry? You think it's going to happen?" I'm like, "Well, there's a lot of good issues here." Like, and then I'm looking at like the 25 minutes have gone by, and I'm like, "So, who wins here? I mean, who really deserves to be paid in this particular situation?" And I love when I make observations because you know me, I'm a heady cat. I think about a lot of stuff. I think about my own head. I think about my own behavior. So I do a lot of introspective work. I'm a navel gazer. I'm the king of self-centeredness, you know. And I'll go in there with some pretty solid theories about why I think certain things, and he'll be like, wow, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, why don't you write that down in your little workbook for the next guy and give me some money back.
No, let me explain something to you.
And now he's going to, I hope he's not listening. Now I feel nervous. He's like, why are we so angry today?
Mm-hmm.
And then we got to go into that.
Remember this.
What?
Professionals, no matter what their work,
okay,
don't give it away for free.
Doctors
don't.
Yeah.
Psychiatrists don't.
Right.
Nobody does.
Sometimes
we don't.
Yeah, actually, that's true. Because last week when I was doing the improv, it's weird. I want to talk to this guy. I'm starting to look forward to this guy, Malcolm
Gladwell.
Yeah, Malcolm Gladwell, the author of this book, Blink. Because I've been doing comedy for years, and when I get into, I can walk into a room, and I've never been able to tell whether I like if I walk into a room and just sort of take a whiff of the audience, like an impulsive sort of boom, what are they? Ooh. Just like pow, how do I feel about these people? A lot of times I'm like, this feels a little bad to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know there's going to be a little tension in here, and I can feel that instinctively. And I don't know if that's like me just feeling, projecting my insecurities or my own fears, or it's true because it becomes hard to tell even when you do the show. Because if you get that in your head, you're going to be going up there, reacting to them in accordance with what you impulsively felt, and that could determine, it could facilitate or manifest exactly what you're fearing.
Do you do that though? I mean, do you like take a pulse of the audience and then act based on the pulse that you feel, that initial pulse?
I've gotten a lot better at it because a lot of times you'll go watch the guy before you and you'd be like, oh, they're laughing at that. I mean, I don't even want them to like me. That kind of thing. But what I was going to say was some woman comes up. She's from Louisiana. She was wearing a red wig. Already, way annoying. And she was like smoking. She's like, oh, you're on the show? Tell me a joke. And like anytime I hear that, I'm like, I'm not going to tell you a joke.
Wow.
I'm not going to do it. You know why? Because I'm a professional, Riley.
That's right.
And also, I didn't want to engage with her, So let's move on to Iraq.
Iraq.
Let's take a flight to Iraq.
Yeah.
So the U.S. sees no advantage in delaying Iraqi elections. Why should, justice and fairness, stop an election process? It didn't stop one here, So
they got a plan, Mark. They're getting out. And the elections are part of it. Just like, winning the, there was a particular point at which, what was that, May of 2003, when Bush said, we've won.
Yeah.
And at this point, he's got his schedule to keep, and the elections are the beginning of the schedule. He's got to get these troops out of there. He's got tax cuts to fund.
Yeah.
He can't keep funding a war, or maybe he can. Just run us all into debt forever.
So you believe that after these elections, obviously, because we've talked to some people who've spent time on the ground in Iraq that said that there were, who was it, Anthony LaPay said that they got bases there that aren't going anywhere.
Yep.
So the military presence is never going to fully end. But you're saying that they're just setting the stage for the occupation end to, I'm sure, a big sort of press hype, glorious thing. We're out, we're over. But they're going to be leaving at least 100,000 troops there, I imagine.
But, see, they're not going to say we're out, it's over. What they're going to say is, look at all the Iraqi troops we've trained. They're wonderful. They're going to pick up the slack. See, they're not going to put it in the context of us leaving. What they're going to put it in the context of is, or I shouldn't even frame that statement that way. They are going to say, well, we've trained the troops. They're in good shape. The country is as safe as, and they're going to continue to, recruit people for the Iraqi police and security forces. Therefore, we don't have to be there in the numbers that we've been there up until now.
Just as advisors.
Yeah.
This is 75,000 advisors.
And part-time assassins, if need be.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, they're not having any consistent success in training a successful Iraqi security force because of the threat of essentially that you're going to leave us hanging. We're going to have to deal with all this business of this sort of multifaceted insurgency. Some of them are our cousins.
Yeah.
And you think we're going to fight on for you?
Well,
You know what?
What?
We got somebody coming up.
Yep.
Still not telling people who it is.
I want to talk about Chertoff.
Oh, yeah. We got to talk about
when
him, too.
Back.
A Jersey guy. When we come back here on Air America Radio.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley. Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition Radio Theater Company players bring you their production of The Shadow Government.
Deep in Washington, D.C., lives a group that has the ability to cloud citizens' minds. What evil lurks in the heart of a shadow government? Mark Maron knows. When we last left our hero, his search for Colin Powell had led him to a New York strip club called the Velvet Peanut. He was looking for a lady with a snake.
Hey, baby. Wanna dance?
Sorry, doll. I'm working a case. I'm a private dick.
You and every other guy who comes in here, except you're a little more private.
I thought you worked with a snake.
I do. He's my boss, and he's waiting for you in the back room.
Well, well, well. Look whose luck just ran out.
It was the torture master himself, Alberta Torquemada Gonzalez, with three of his goons. And they were looking at me the way Laura Bush would look at Harvey Firestein. And that ain't pretty, no matter which way you're facing. Surprised to see you here, Gonzalez. Guess I didn't get the memo.
Keep cracking wise, Seamus. I'm about to get Abu Ghraib on your ass. Grab him, boys.
Hey, wait, guy. Oh, they worked me over like I was Cat Stevens going through airport security. When I came to, I was strapped to a chair, tied up worse than a universal health care bill in committee. And Gonzalez was coming toward me with a bullwhip.
You're gonna tell me what you know about Powell, but I only know one way to ask.
I knew Gonzalez was just trying to rattle me, but he was gone. Wacko, playing with half a deck. He was zeroing in on me like a senior citizen on a bottle of Canadian blood pressure pills.
Is this the champagne room?
It was my pal Bill Clinton with a friend. Hey, Bubba, get me out of here.
Hey, buddy. Gonzalez, now I know what's going on here. Let him go.
You want him? Come and get him.
You know, my doctor said I should avoid spicy foods, but I'm in the mood for a little Mexican.
Oh, great. The squeaky little lawyer from Houston versus the 58-year-old former president with a heart condition. These guys had less muscle than a Guantanamo prisoner on a hunger strike.
You hit like a girl, Clinton.
That was a girl. This is Mindy. I met her at the bar. This is me.
Gonzalez went down like Bush's job numbers.
You all right, buddy?
Yeah. Just help me get untied. I looked around. Gonzalez had vanished quicker than mainstream news coverage of the Iraq War. I gotta light out of here, Bubba, and find Colin Powell.
Powell? Buddy, he's in Washington, hawking his resume like Rumsfeld handed out no-bid contracts to Halliburton.
New York was a bum steer, and Washington was calling my name. But I had one more thing to do.
These dances are on me, buddy. And when you get to Washington, remember what I told you about the inauguration.
Will Mark get to Washington in time to save Colin Powell from the swinging, razor-sharp death trap over the Jefferson Memorial? Have I just given away next week's episode? Can you disregard everything I just said? Find out next time when we hear Mindy say...
I don't care if he is your friend, Bill. That cheap bastard didn't hit me.
That's next week on The Shadow Government. And remember to tune in later to Morning Sedition's old-time radio presentation of the comedy team of Maron and Riley.
I'm asking you for the last time, who's in the first segment of the show this morning?
No, who's in the fifth segment after the news break?
I'm not asking what's in the fifth segment.
No, who's in the fifth segment? What's in the third segment?
I don't give a darn who's in the third segment.
Oh, he's doing traffic and weather.
No!
That's the comedy team of Maron and Riley. Coming up later.
Oh, Lord.
There you go. Man, we were having a good time.
We were having a good time. That was well done.
The entire bunch was in here. PW was in here, and Clutch, and Dan Pashman, Son of Lewis, and Linda Pashman. Of course, PW
McDonald on the voice of Alberto Gonzalez.
Oh, you gave that away?
Yeah.
I think we might have to bring him back because, you know, you're going to Washington, aren't you?
Yeah. Oh, no, he'll be back, but I want to give him credit where credit was due. That was hilarious.
It's a big whip, I'll say that.
that was funny, man. So, Michael Chertoff.
Yes.
Michael Chertoff, Bush's nominee for Homeland Security Chief.
Yes.
Not a good guy. And dig this. We get an email from one of our listeners, Jason, out there in the world. Michael Chertoff, George Bush's nomination for Secretary of Homeland Security, name is Russian for owned by the devil. Yes, the man who will be in charge of security of this country has a name that says he's owned by the devil. I think there's some irony there, just a bit. And we did some research on it, and I think it actually might mean son of the devil.
Yeah.
You know, it could mean owned by the devil in some context. I don't know Russian slang, but the suffix off, you know, means son of, and chert means devil. So he is the son
of the
devil, and now he is in the employ of the neocon death cult.
Well, he's been actually in the employ of the neocon death cult for a long time.
I'm glad you said that seriously.
Yeah.
I like when you say it.
He's the former U.S. attorney for the state of New Jersey. His one redeeming virtue was that he went after the attorney general of the state of New Jersey over the issue of racial profiling. This is going back some time now, but he actually pushed this guy, Peter Venero, out of office as New Jersey's attorney general. Since then,
because of
racial profiling.
So he stood up against racial profiling.
Yeah, he stood up against it. Venero denied it existed, essentially, and Chertoff actually got the stats, got the numbers, and pushed him the hell out.
But he also stood up against Miranda rights. He also stood up, pro-torture on some level.
Oh, well, he has done a whole bunch of stuff since then. For example, overseeing the detention of 762 foreign nationals for immigration violations. None of them were ever charged with terrorism-related crimes. The Justice Department, by the way, determined that no-bond policy for detainees led to lengthy delays in releasing them from prison, where some faced a, quote, pattern of physical and verbal abuse. Are all of the abusers now coming into these top positions in the cabinet?
Of course.
Gonzalez and now him? And what's up with this?
Well, that's how demons are promoted. That's how demons are rewarded.
Yeah.
It's like, thank you for being a devil. Thank you for making a sacrifice. Thank you for sacrificing whatever little integrity you had, you know, and taking part of our demonic rituals in order for global domination. You will be rewarded with a promotion. Keep playing our game, and we will always take care of you.
Well, you know, he's also, and of course, this is going to, I think, come up when he's questioned by the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
There are questions about his role in the John Walker Lind case,
mm-hmm.
because there are newly disclosed documents that the New York Times is reporting in the paper today that conflict with assertions made to Congress by Chertoff. And that's the question of whether or not Chertoff should have been questioned while he had told people he had a lawyer. His family had retained a lawyer for him. And Chertoff's argument was, well, the lawyer wasn't going to Afghanistan, so we had to question him where we had him. But the question of whether or not Walker Lind, as an American citizen, should have been questioned when he did, without his lawyer being present, when he had a lawyer, is going to be something that's going to come up because Chertoff oversaw that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know how I feel about John Walker Lind. Yeah, he was a traitor, but he also took the semester abroad to a whole new level.
Level, yeah. Well, he's doing 20 long right now, that's for sure.
Well, that's going to be a whole other education there.
Now, he also co-wrote a brief for the Supreme Court case Chavez versus Martinez. He argued in that brief that there is no general constitutional right to be free of coercive police questioning. So in other words, if a cop is giving you the blues, Michael Chertoff said that's okay.
Yeah.
Even if you're an innocent guy who just happens to be going over the George Washington Bridge at 3:30 in the morning. I'm only kidding.
So he's enabling and allowing torture on the level of the police if need be.
Well, you know, this was a very celebrated case. This was a guy named Oliverio Martinez who was shot 5 times by cops who thought that he was selling drugs. He wasn't. In the ambulance and then at the hospital, a cop supervisor who had arrived at the scene interrogated Martinez without reading him Miranda warnings in order to get him to admit that he had reached for a cop's gun before he got shot. The Solicitor General filed an amicus brief co-written by Chertoff supporting the police, which would have been a reversal of the Miranda decision.
Now, all these things, it's interesting with these type of judicial people where, you know, he's like a king of slippery slopes. Like, all of these things that he's dealing with could really lead to slippery slopes to taking away, you know, human rights almost altogether in terms of the law.
And to me, there's a startling parallel between him and Gonzalez.
Mm-hmm.
The kinds of things that they are willing to do in the name of national security, in the name of fighting terrorism, in the name of all these different amorphous things. And they do, in fact, erode people's basic rights, and they seem to be comfortable with it, and that troubles me greatly. I don't know.
Well, then, you know, the question is, it's like, hey, but it's not everybody. I mean, it's there for a specific reason, but that's now.
Once
these things on the books, you know, they become a standard. They become a precedent.
Yeah.
And they can be used for whatever is necessary by, you know, whatever's deemed necessary by the people in power at the time. We will be back with
a surprise guest.
Really? Still, we're going to do that?
We're going to play the game right up until the end, man.
All right.
We got to keep people listening to this.
44 past the hour. It's Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests. Our comedy. Your blog. MorningSedition.com. Courtesy of Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo!
The show is Morning Sedition. The network is Air America Radio. On the phone, we have the former mayor of Cincinnati, Ohio. He's going to be launching Springer on the radio on Monday, January 17th, where his lead-in in the Cincinnati area. Good morning, Jerry Springer. How are you?
Hey, Jerry.
Hey, guys. How are you? And I couldn't have a better lead-in, could I?
Well, thank you very much. That's nice of you to say.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do on the radio?
Yeah.
Hopefully help change the playing field or the level of the playing field in one area of the Midwest at least. This is Cincinnati and Southern Ohio is an area where they only get the conservative point of view. It's, you know, the airwaves, except for you guys, are dominated by that.
Well, you're also up against some serious, accusations of election fraud in that area. I mean, are you going to be dealing with that at all in your first week or two? Because there's a lot of angry
sure.
Democrats and also just good American
yeah,
people.
But it's more than just that case, clearly. Nothing probably will be divulged that will change the outcome of the election. But the problem has been, at least on the Democratic side, that there has been no coming together in terms of, you know, what does it mean to be a Democrat?
Mm-hmm.
What is the other point of view? And so what happens, come in election time, everything then is suddenly focused on the particular candidate because we don't have a reservoir of a position on issues which really affect people's lives. And then we're trying to suddenly come up with stands on the issues, and we get accused of waffling. In other words, if there's going to be any hope 4 years from now in terms of having a candidate that can actually contest for the presidency, we're going to have to start to develop a consistency on our issues right now. And that includes the war in Iraq, and it includes whether or not we ought to have a doctrine of preemption. It includes what we're going to do about Social Security. I mean, there is a move by this administration that has been going on since its inception to basically start to undo 70, 80 years of social good.
That's right.
To eliminate Social Security, in a sense. Privatization is just a code word for saying, let's get the government out of securing people's lives.
Yeah, you're right about that. Jerry, I'm reading an article about your new show, and it says that it quotes a guy from Clear Channel saying he won't dive in every day with a political agenda. He plans to have fun first. What is fun like for Jerry Springer on the radio?
Well, we'll do some skits. We'll have some characters. It needs to be entertaining. You guys know that.
Yeah, sure.
If it's going to be a three-hour lecture every day, no one's going to tune in. So, first of all, it has to be entertaining. But in the course of entertaining and having some fun and talking about the news that's going on that day, we're going to hopefully give voice to another point of view. I'm not saying there's never a conservative position that makes any sense. What I am saying is, if that is the only position people hear day in and day out, there's a wonderful book, The Republican Noise Machine by David Brock.
Sure.
And, you know, it really outlines what the conservative establishment has done over the last 20 years. We have to start doing that, too. It's not just a matter of finding a candidate and saying, boy, this is a good-looking guy, and he's articulate, and he served in a war, so let's run him. That's not going to work.
Well, that would help, though.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Not a bad start.
Sure. It's a good start if he was good-looking.
Yeah,
right.
That's why they're putting a... me on radio, because the people who can't stand the sight of me.
Wait, Jerry, are you saying that it's your only other option? If it weren't for the way you look, you'd be president?
It's unbelievable. Maybe king.
At least a senator from Ohio. Yeah. Why not?
Yeah, maybe king. In fact, I was born in England, actually, but I left when I found out I couldn't be king. So here I am. Now I think I got a shot here.
Now, Jerry, in terms of your show, who do you want to have as your first guest when you debut next week?
I'm busy.
Yeah. Huh. Well, me too, but, you know, we'll now available
gonna,
later.
Well, now we're going to have to regroup. We're working on various people. Obviously, it'd be great to have, you know, the former President Clinton. But, you know, we'll see. I know because I've been through this in terms of other jobs I have. I remember the first time I was doing the news or the first time I had the TV show. You spend forever thinking about who your first guest is in that first show. And, of course, in the long run, if you're going to be on every day, hopefully for years and years and years, no one remembers the first show anyway.
Yeah, I certainly don't remember our first show.
Me neither.
But, you know, yeah. if you get Clinton, say hi to him for us, because we've had him before, Jerry. He's
yeah.
been on our show.
Yeah, he's old news.
Yeah.
But now, Jerry,
okay.
are you going
to...
We love Bill
yeah,
Clinton
Chelsea
here.
Yeah, just said, okay,
yeah,
Jerry.
Right? But maybe you could ask him about this whole thing with old man Bush, though, because it kind of irritated us.
That invariably happens. I mean, I think it's almost something happens when you get inside the White House. It becomes this very small fraternity, and somehow when they leave, it all happens. I mean, look how close Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford are.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of nice now, you know, they're older men and all that. But if you back in the 70s, you know, these guys detested each other. And so I just think that's natural and normal. And, you know, who knows, maybe one day George W. will be hanging out with Hillary.
Well, you kind
oh,
of,
yeah, right.
Maybe not. Maybe not.
There's some part of me that wants them to continue having contempt for each other, because it strikes me as, I know it's a small club, and, you know, they like to sit around and talk about, you know, how they, you know, ruled the world at one time, and there's only a few people they can really do that with. But, you know, nonetheless, it seems to me that it makes them seem a little disingenuous when you get guys who are, you know, sworn enemies and swear at each other, or at least on the first president Bush's part, slandering
yeah.
Clinton like he did. You just sort of like Clinton to say, you know what, I'll do this on my own. Screw you.
Well, I think maybe on that particular case, I see it this way.
Yeah.
One, I don't think George Bush the father, I don't think either of the Bushes, regardless of what you think of them personally, I don't think either of them ever had strong world political views. I think they loved the idea of being a president or being in charge, and they developed the philosophy as they went along. So there's nothing deeply believed by George Bush Sr., 41, that would make it hard for him to adopt ultimately any position. With Bill Clinton, I don't think Clinton ever, ever was a vicious-type campaigner. That wasn't his politics. His politics was always, his triangulation theory basically was, you know, let's work with the Republicans somehow and make it, you know, I don't think he was fiercely partisan.
Mm.
That wasn't his strength. And so it's not hard for them to get together.
But they tried to run him out of town for 8 years. I mean, you know, these guys had a momentum against him. I mean, political not. Or,
they were
or
haters.
Not. And whether or not,
I think Clinton, I honestly think Clinton kills you with kindness. I mean, remember him speaking at Nixon's
sure,
funeral.
Sure. Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
He had tears in his eyes. I mean, that's how Clinton is. He never, you know, never nails you. He just...
Right.
He's getting, you know, it's rope-a-dope.
How are you with that? Can you cry on cue, Jerry? Or
unbelievable.
Hey, Jerry, now that you're going to be a player on the national political stage, who do you like for DNC chair, Jerry?
Dean may be a good start.
Yeah.
And I realize, you know, he's clearly probably the most controversial. I think he's... And, you know, there'll be people screaming and yelling, as he did that night. But, you know what? We got to stand for something. This business about, you know, let's always go the safe way. And the result is people realize you're doing that. They realize you don't stand for anything. And therefore, in the tough fight, you know, they're not going to side with you.
Couldn't agree with you more, Jerry. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, we appreciate it, Jerry.
Good luck with the launch.
Hey, thanks, guys. And if I don't have anything to say, you just keep talking longer. Go into my mind.
Fine. Not a problem.
All right, Jerry.
You take care. Jerry Springer here. So what do we got coming up next hour?
I don't know. We just got an early endorsement of Howard
Dean. Malcolm Gladwell?
Yeah, Malcolm Gladwell. I want to find out about this blinking without thinking, thinking without blinking.
That'll
when we come
good.
Back on Air America Radio.
I'm Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Blah, 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 blah.
Good morning, geniuses.
Ooh.
Yes, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians, tops and bottoms of all kinds. Welcome. Welcome aboard the great arc of Air America Radio.
That's right. We got two of everything here.
We sure do. You got three of something. That's Mark Riley.
Yeah, where?
Clark
he owes Larson me money.
Does he? Does
yeah.
Mark Riley owe you money?
Yeah.
Look at Wayne Gellman. See, Wayne Gellman. No. No.
Hey, what are you, Jake Plummer?
Wayne Gellman just flipped Mark Riley up from the news booth.
That's because of something I did during the break. I don't know.
Let
me look.
I just have
a lighthearted look at the world here. Right, Wayne?
That's right. Right.
Come back when you don't have to stay so long.
He has no idea what you're saying. Quatch Larson's in the booth.
No, he's listening.
Cheering up. Yeah, Brendan P.W. McDonald over there. Kalo's on the board. Kalo, what's going on, man? You're on the jerky again?
That's right, baby.
What's with the jerky?
Yeah.
I can't. You bring in these bags of jerky. Where's that article?
Take human bites.
Yeah, where's that? Hold on. What article? What's wrong with jerky?
Oh, yeah. The article about the colon cancer thing.
Oh.
He's not trying to scare the guy.
Wait. They don't make beef jerky out of colon cancer, do they?
No.
Wait, no. Because then I might not eat it.
You got a 30% greater risk.
Oh, those are mad cow Twizzlers that you're eating.
Yeah.
Listen to this.
Mmm, tastes like chicken.
Why do you think they make jerky? I mean, you got to figure, Kalo. It's like, okay, you've got good steak, you got crappy steak, then you got the steak that no one's going to eat. Let's take a poll. Which one do you think they make jerky out of?
How bad meat?
The good steak?
All right, so.
No, not the good steak, huh?
No, what are you kidding me?
What, they said that's a fast food?
They use stuff for jerky that they're like, should we throw it out or no?
No.
Let's make jerky out of it.
But, Maren, honestly,
what?
I can't afford the good steak anyway, so I'm eating it all.
Hey,
all
wasn't
the time.
That you they're I saw in front
heart.
Of Peter Luger's, man?
Oh, my
that's
God.
All you can. Now, Kalo's getting ready to, he's thinking about traveling again, too, you know.
Are you going, oh, yeah, that's right, you want to go to London.
Yeah,
huh?
London, yeah. Maybe a little bit Italy.
Go to the capital of Mad Cow and you know, and have a steak in London.
I'll take a picture with the cow.
I got to take you out, man. I'll take you and we'll get a porterhouse for two or four. That's a deal, all right?
You sure?
You know what? Why don't we all go to Peter Luger's, the whole team?
They got any chicken there?
I'm doing this on the look at now. Wait,
Hey, wait! You're buying, pal. That'll be enough to keep him away. No.
There comes that finger again. All right, so. Oh, boy. No, let's do that. Wait, John. Jonathan
Larson can't eat anything that looks like meat.
But he's so funny. Like he says in my head that he eats lots of meat, actually.
Really?
And, it's just a core plan. But can you have a nice big porterhouse for two slathered in butter? Can you have that?
Mushrooms.
He just said yes.
Yes. Let's do it. As long as he doesn't have any vegetables.
Oh, there's Pashman. Yeah, I'm ready. I'm ready to go.
Oh, yeah, there he goes.
And Pashman's probably got some sort of weird ritual about going to Peter Luger's. When you go to Peter Luger's, you have to get a gin and tonic, you know, but you got to ask the guy. You know, I don't know what it is.
Hey, but you know what?
Jack
we didn't
Coke.
Talk about this. Something we didn't talk about.
What?
You, the Black Eyed Peas, and Dan Pashman.
That's what I thought we talked about that earlier. Yeah, well,
talked about the Black Eyed Peas, but you didn't say that you had given it all to Pashman.
Well, I gave it to Pashman, you know, as a gesture because, you know, Pashman and I are cooks, Dan Pashman and Son of Lewis and Lynn Pashman, and he's got me into this crocking mode.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I moved back to New York, some guy left a crock pot at my apartment, and I never used a crock pot, so I started using it, and then I get the job here, and of course, Pashman's like, oh, dude, when you're crock potting, you got to, you know, and then there's a list of things I had to do. But he crocks, so now I'm crocking. So now I feel like he gave me a taste of something he made the other day that was pretty good. So I brought in a little something. It's cute. You know what I mean?
Let me tell you what you guys have gotten me into now, because this is getting to be ridiculous.
Here's what you do. If you don't think it's something you need, you go, what's that? Yeah. Huh?
No.
How's that?
No.
No, but you want to eat some of that
today.
I'm going to bring some tomorrow.
I saw a recipe for, I guess it's crock pot lobster macaroni and cheese. Now, that I would eat.
Dan Fassman, son of Lewis and Linda Fassman, crock pot, lobster, macaroni, and cheese.
Yeah, how about that?
I don't know about lobster. You like lobster.
I love lobster.
That's like one of the four things you eat.
Yes.
Next week we're going
from the four basic food groups.
We're going to Fancy Place next week.
We're going
to Danielle with Alan Richman, the food critic. And it's going to be me and you and Fassman and PW. And are you coming too?
Kalo's coming.
I want to.
I don't know. I think you might be on the air, dude.
No,
I don't know. But you know what?
What?
I'm going to drive that chef crazy.
I know. Well, we've already had the email exchanges. We've had to decide what to eat. Riley only eats macaroni and cheese, dry turkey, and some fish.
Dry white turkey.
Yeah, that's what they're preparing you, but they're going to do it in the French way. Dry white turkey.
With jelly French. Cranberry sauce, all right? Yeah. Don't come with that other stuff.
Oh, but here's what I was getting at. I don't know. Kalo, dig this. Scientists who studied the eating patterns of nearly 149,000 American adults over two decades found that those who ate the most red and processed meat over a 10-year period had a 30% higher risk of colon cancer and 40% greater risk of rectal cancer. But those who ate jerky had a 75% higher risk of colon cancer and a 40% risk of just appearing weird with jerky. You know, but Brendan's a big jerky guy, too. PW, he likes the jerky. I got to be honest with you. It's tasty stuff. And is this important? No. But I find myself eating a lot more fish as I get older and making black-eyed peas with smoked turkey as opposed to big slabs of pig. Just the way I am. And my father's been whining. He's been telling me, stay away from the meat. It's all bad.
Really?
For years. Ever since the first mad cow. But you know what? It's a weird thing about, I don't know if it's just Americans, but there's something about it. It's like, you know, you heard about the one case, and of course it was like, this pig was from, or this cow is from Canada. It's not an American cow. And then there was another case, of course, another Canadian cow.
Yeah.
And then you start really assessing, what are the FDA regulations? What are the USDA regulations? What is really done? If you read Eric Schlosser's book, It's a Disaster, and you think to yourself, it's got to be out there. But you know what? Sometimes you just want to have a steak, and you're willing to take the risk. You know what I mean?
Have you ever been able to find out what grub steak was? You know, when I was a kid, I used to watch these westerns all the time.
I know we're going to find out momentarily.
No, I don't. I have no idea what it is, but they always say, a grub steak, and I never knew what that was.
What grub means?
Well, I knew that grub was like,
food,
I guess the western word
it might
food.
Be a cut of steak.
Yeah.
I mean, I know what a skirt steak is. I know what a flank steak is. I know what a London broil is. Skirt steak's really good, actually.
Yeah, I used to love steak. I haven't had it in like 10, 15 years now. But I got to ask you something, because I know there's one thing that you love besides cooking.
Mm.
Music.
Yeah.
You love music, don't
you? Yes, sir. I do. Of course I like music. And I've been jamming.
Well, you know, it's funny. There is a family, speaking of grub, there's a husband and wife team that are actually putting together the music for Bush's inaugural.
Oh, really?
Their name is Grub. Dennis and Cynthia Grubb, I swear to God.
I didn't know that we were going somewhere with that.
Hey, it's the truth. These guys, and see, the reason why I bring these people up is that this is a pattern with George W. Bush. These are people that have known him since they were, I think, in high school in Midland, Texas. They've been around for eons. And these are guys, you know what they do? For a living when they're not doing inaugurations, they do, they arrange corporate musical guests. You know, like...
Sure.
Low-level cover bands.
Oh, yeah,
they know everyone in Texas.
That is the shadow show business industry, believe me. And, Asleep at the Wheel is going to be playing. They are. I remember them. I remember Asleep at the Wheel. They were a country rock band, weren't they, in the 70s?
Yeah.
But there is a whole sub-level of show business. I know guys doing comedy for, 25 years that you would never even heard of make a good living.
Yeah.
Doing corporate events and this and that.
Boat rides and cruises.
Yeah, that's where you get the term boat act. You ever heard that? You know what a boat act is? A boat act was the comedian's word for basically a hack. Somebody would play it safe, not use any cussing. There was a boat act, and usually there was maybe props involved, but a boat act was not a good thing to be.
Well, these guys apparently went around booking groups like Vince Vance and the Valiants.
Wow.
Corporate events. And now they're doing the inauguration. They've been working in D.C. for the last, several months. And I guess maybe, the article that I'm reading doesn't say this, but I got to figure, weren't they perhaps the coordinators of the now infamous Kid Rock non-appearance?
I don't know. I don't know what the validation is. Randy was talking about saying that he was invited. They're saying that he was never invited. I don't know. But I do know on another music note, Bob Marley is going to be relocated. Posthumously relocated. So he's got no real say in the matter. But his wife, Rita, has decided that he will be moving to Ethiopia.
Ethiopia, after being dead for 24 years.
On the 60th anniversary of Marley's birth around there, there's a month-long celebration. He was going to move to, I guess, the homeland of the Rastafarian movement.
Yes.
And what do you think? You tend to have a history.
I met Bob Marley, played soccer with him in the hallway at our old studio. So the problem is, Rita Marley, in doing this, kind of sort of backhanded disrespected Jamaica. So I get a feeling that Jamaicans aren't going to be too happy with this.
All right. Well, maybe we'll talk about it a little more. Look at Wayne Gelman looking sad in the window over there.
Oh, you heard Bob Marley.
There's going to be some trouble. Yeah. I can feel trouble. It's 16 past the hour at Air America Radio.
Who are these people? Morning Sedition.
It's on record. It's out. It's no secret anymore.
Morning Sedition from Air America Radio.
Past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
A morning sedition. This is Air America Radio. Now, you know, Charlie Grainer, specialist Charles Grainer, is, of course, you know, on trial. And there's been some testimony from some Syrians, a Syrian guy who was held in
Abu Ghraib. Yeah.
And said that Grainer was just a nightmare, just laughed at him, tortured them, and he completely acted like he was having a good time. And I guess that because of that, somehow or another, Raymond, who came looking pretty beat up this morning.
Yeah, he did look like he got nervous.
Gave us Charles Grainer's Palm Pilot for today. 7 a.m., wake up, masturbate, before the jailer forces me to masturbate. See, I win again. 8 a.m., call Indy, make sure the baby is leashed. 9 a.m., meet with lawyer before court-martial trial. Now that man disturbs me. Comparing prison abuse to cheerleading? Sick. Venal. 9:30 a.m., discuss strategy with lawyer. When Muslim prisoners accuse me of forcing them to eat pork and drink alcohol, reply that, back home, we call that breakfast. 1 p.m., court martial trial. Reminder, don't stack pencils. 3 p.m., watch abuse videos. Tell the court, in my defense, these were much funnier with the sound effects. Hello. 7 p.m., back in cell. Masturbate. They'll never break me. I know the drill.
By the way, are we starting an office pool on how much time he's going to get?
What do you think?
Oh, let's see. He gave John Walker Lynn 20 years. I would say 7 to 10.
That's, I think he's a ringleader, right? Well, actually, I'm sorry. That's not true. Donald Rumsfeld
is
the
ringleader. He's getting off scot-free. Don't worry about it.
All the guys that should be really doing jail time is Stephen Cambone, Donald Rumsfeld, Alberto Gonzalez.
All of them.
Yeah, where's their jail time?
It's called Washington, D.C. They're going to be working as lobbyists, as attorney generals, as whatever.
Well, hopefully we can turn all this around. You know, I was listening to this Ted Kennedy speech, and I was reading the transcript. And, you know, he really, every once in a while, he'll come right out and get right to the forefront and lay it out.
He's got the fire.
Yeah. On Wednesday he did. This is a piece from John Kennedy. Wow. Edward M. Kennedy at the National Press Club on Wednesday. Can we hear that, Kalo?
We have an administration that falsely hypes almost every issue as a crisis. They did it on Iraq, and they are doing it now on Social Security. They exploit the politics of fear and division, while ours is a politics of hope and unity. In the face of their tactics, we cannot move our party or our nation forward under the pale colors and timid voices. If we do, we will lose again and deserve to lose. As I have said on other occasions, the last thing our country needs is two Republican parties.
And I want to follow that with the Reverend James Forbes of the Riverside Church in Harlem, who was on our show. And I just love listening to this piece. I like his voice.
Yeah.
We better go into our values. And I don't mean two values.
Mm-hmm.
I mean the broad values upon which this nation was built. And that includes care for those who can't care for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It means productivity based on regulations that are fair for all of the people. It is based on a global vision that we are the global leaders. What is our vision for the globe? And how do we manifest that in our own nature? And we're going to be discussing how do religious values stop destroying folks and actually build up community and get us ready for the mission that is ahead.
That was Reverend James Forbes when he was on our show a couple months ago. We should have him back. He's from the Riverside Church up there in Harlem. Now, I think that Kennedy's absolutely right, and he said a lot of things that are absolutely right, and this is, you know, and also in support of what Jerry Springer said just moments ago on our show. Chris, can we hear that?
Who do you like for DNC chair, Jerry?
Dean may be a good start, and I realize, you know, he's clearly probably the most controversial, but you know what? We got to stand for something. This business about, you know, let's always go the safe way. And the result is people realize you're doing that. They realize you don't stand for anything. And therefore, in a tough fight, you know, they're not going to side with you.
You know, it's like this is we cannot move towards this mythical center again.
Yeah, yeah. Well, see, I think that this is what Ted Kennedy was doing in making this kind of fiery speech in Washington yesterday. What he's doing is saying, look, we can't afford to have any more John Bros. We can't afford to have any more Zell Millers in our party, and particularly in Congress, mm-hmm. working against the interests of the Democratic Party. Remember, Bush is searching for a Democrat to break ranks with the party, a blue dog. I don't want to use Gary Condit as an example, but he was a blue dog Democrat when he was in Congress. These are people who will find common cause with the Republicans under certain circumstances and for certain pieces of legislation. Senator Kennedy, by saying what he said and coming out four square with some solid goals to be achieved, universal health care, which is what he said in terms of expanding Medicare to cover all Americans. Education, signing a contract with eighth graders that would guarantee them a free college education if they put their nose to the grindstone. These kinds of programs, these are the things that you can build a platform that Americans can bond with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know that many Americans, I don't care what state they live in, that don't want to see their kids go to college.
And I really want, you know, I really want the members of Congress and the senators that we have to you know, really start standing up. You know, as disappointed as I was that they didn't all stand up with Barbara Boxer, you know, mm-hmm. in support of the election fraud, you know, they should have all stood up.
They should have all stood up.
They should have
safety in numbers.
Yeah, what would have mattered? The debate was going to happen anyways, but instead of thinking like, well, let Boxer do it, and then she'll instigate the debate, and we don't have to. They should have all stood up. I just hope that they are able to effectively filibuster. I hope that, you know, Frist does not pull the nuclear option. I hope that they start to just speak, you know, the values of the Democratic Party and come together. And I hope that we can pull a couple of those Republicans who are on the fence, that not necessarily siding with the Democrats, but at least siding against the president.
Yeah, and I think that at a point, you know, Howard Dean would certainly not be the worst thing that could happen to the Democratic National Committee.
Definitely
I don't care
not.
What the Fox News Channel says. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about thinking without thinking with Malcolm Gladwell,
mm-hmm.
author of Blink.
It's going to be wild.
It is going to be wild. This is Air America Radio.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley. Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
An alternate universe wouldn't be an alternative universe. Luckily, we have a staffer who lives in that world. So now on the phone once again is Planet Bush correspondent Lawton Smalls. Good morning, Lawton.
Good morning, Mark. God's got you in the crock pot, and he's slow cooking the sin right out of you.
Yeah, okay, good.
You're getting all juicy now.
Oh, yes, I am.
Yeah.
All right. Today, you know, with all the tsunamis and mudslides, I think we should talk about the threat of global warming.
Well, Lawton. Mark, I got news for you. There's no such thing as Santa Claus, and there's no such thing as global warming. That's unicorns and fairy dust, my friend. Gandalf and Frodo. That's Elrond and Rivendell, my friend.
Look, well, maybe Santa. All right, I get what you're saying.
Bunyan.
Well, maybe Santa isn't around because the polar ice caps have melted, Lawton. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, to listen to you, people would think the entire northern region of the planet was covered in ice.
That's
why President Bush is careful to make sure whatever scientist he's talking to does not have a mind that's clouded by certain things.
What do you mean? Like what?
Well, like science. I mean, that's why he gets most of his scientific information from the Book of Ephesians. I mean, that's God's weather channel right there. Come on, Mark. When you come down to it, what has science really given us?
Yeah, how about penicillin, heat, electricity, airplanes, automobiles?
You.
What?
Thank you.
Yeah.
You just proved it. Science is the cause of global warming.
No.
You go cry to scientists to solve all your problems.
No.
Help me, Frodo.
No.
Come on,
all right, man. All right. But look, according to Bush, there's no problem.
Exactly. Ignoring problems is a major component of presidential leadership.
Wait, what?
According to you, the president should waste all his time worried about the survival of the planet
when Social Security has to be privatized and queers are still stalking.
Wait a minute. Now, that's just wrong.
Now, those are
you,
problems,
that is,
friend.
You know what? That's really wrong. Are you planning to live your whole life ignoring science and medicine?
No, Mark, of course not. I go to a doctor.
Yeah.
And just the other day, I was in for my weekly skin graft.
Whoa. We had skin grafts? What's the matter, what?
Well, it was a minor procedure. I had a little sunburn.
Uh-huh.
Over 85% of my body.
Wow.
I made the mistake of spending the first week of January in International Falls, Minnesota.
Oh, no. What's the matter, man?
Talk about global warming. It was minus 5 degrees in Minnesota.
Wow.
My skin turned red and then orange and then purple. I look like a spoiled rack of ribs. My little lung almost fell off.
Oh, no.
I like to walk around nude on vacation.
Oh,
is that so wrong?
No, you're full of surprises. That's too bad, man. I'm sorry,
buddy. I'm nude and it burned me.
I hope your next vacation is better, buddy. Are you all right?
You know, this summer I'm renting a cabin that's literally on top of Old Smoky in the Smoky
Mountains. All right, that's great.
You know why I'm going there? Because I always wanted to learn how to surf.
Huh?
I hear the ocean waves are fantastic in southern Tennessee. That's where global warming does for you. You know, they don't have a problem with my nudity
all
there
right,
either.
Well,
I can walk
you.
Around
all right,
my little lockdown all day long.
All right, that's more information than I need. Thank you, Watton.
God loves you.
Yep.
Deal with it.
All right. Very good.
He's drifting off the ranch a little over there, isn't he?
Lately, he has, like, he's surprising, full of surprises. Right now, in the studio, is the author of Blink, The Power of Thinking Without Thinking, and the bestseller, The Tipping Point, How Little Things Can Make a Big Difference. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker. Good morning, Malcolm Gladwell. How are you?
I'm good. Good morning. Good morning.
You know, I'm sitting here. I've read the first the chapter, the introduction chapter of this book, and I like, you know, because it's really about not impulsive thinking, but first reactions, gut reactions, I guess you would call them. And I had a gut reaction to the book, as you brought my attention to in reading the introduction. And then I saw I had a gut reaction to your picture, and I'm judging your picture. I was like, what's resonating off of you in this picture right now? And now I see the real guy, and I have a lot of thoughts about that came from an initial thought of this guy's going to be intense. He's going to be quiet a little bit, but he's going to be very informative.
Well, do you think those are right?
We're going to find
out. We'll find out. We got about 15, 20 minutes to find out.
What is the premise of the book essentially about those type of thoughts that every one of us have that, you know, very few of us follow, really?
Well, I guess the premise is there's an awful lot more going on in that first 2 seconds than we think.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it's really good, and some of it is really, really problematic.
Okay.
And if we want to sort of fix things, make the world a better place, to use a corny phrase, I think we've got to take what goes on in those first 2 seconds really serious.
Now, the part that you're saying that is problematic and the part that is good is that I'm assuming that the good parts, if I understand correctly some of the introduction I read, is that, you know, there are instinctual drives and there are instinctual reactions that are truly instinctual and meant to help with the perseverance of the person.
Yes.
Yes. And some of these, though, in the modern world, without attaching reason to them, could become very destructive for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, about half, the book is sort of half of it is describing cases and instances where this kind of ability is enormously useful and powerful. And the other half is detailing instances where it screws us up.
Okay.
So, for example, I have a whole chapter talking about the fact that why are all the CEOs of Fortune 500 companies tall? I called up 300 Fortune 500 companies, and I got the average the heights of all the CEOs and averaged them out. And they're really tall.
Like guys. What?
They're on average, they're over 6 feet.
Really?
And the average man is 5'9".
Really?
But a good chunk of them are well over 6 foot. Because there's about 30 or 40% of them who are over 6'3", I think. And only about 2% of American men are over 6 foot. So basically, it's not just white people, and it's not just men. It's tall white men, right? Now, is there any sense to the fact that they'd be choosing people to lead companies who belong to this extraordinarily narrow slice of the human race, right? It doesn't make any sense. Now, if you ask them, are you only choosing, you know, this guy because he's tall, they would say, no, tallness has nothing to do with it. We picked him because he's smart and whatever. But clearly the fact of someone being tall is influencing their snap judgment. They see some guy, he's tall, and something about that says to them, oh, he must be the right man for this company, he must be a good leader, he must be smart. There's a case where a snap judgment is clearly screwing us up.
So you mean there's a snap judgment, then there's layers of rationalizations that are stacked on top of it.
Stacked on top of it. And that says to me, we've got to find a way of disentangling that.
Oh, interesting.
You know, it's a good thing Mike Bloomberg is mayor, because, you know, he was CEO. I mean, he must be the shortest CEO in America.
The funny thing is, I have an exception. People who founded their own companies,
okay,
they can be short, right? Because no one picked them.
Yeah, nobody picked them.
I wonder how many of them are actually short, and how they sort of Napoleonic disposition leads to
the kind of sort of a rare. It's funny. You see a handful of. I had this big grid of all the heights of all the Fortune 100 CEOs, and there's a handful that are really short, and you wonder like what, you know, they must be really remarkable in some way, but it's you go down the list, it's like 6'4", 6'3", 6'2", 6'4", 6'1".
Uh-huh.
And you just think, isn't that weird? I mean, I found that weird. I mean, that's the kind of thing that I got fascinated in with when writing this book, which was, and then you can go from there and look at things like, you know, the role of race and the role of gender and the role of all these things that play this role that I think we're very bad at acknowledging.
Hmm.
Well, you know, it's interesting because that whole thing about people, you know, crossing the street when they see me coming, you know, I mean, we talk about the role of race. The fact of the matter is that people sometimes are not comfortable around, certainly not black men my age, but younger black men. I know black people that aren't comfortable around younger black men.
Yeah.
And I don't know. But, you know, one question I wanted to ask you right off the top.
Mm-hmm.
I know I have first impressions about a lot of stuff, and in many cases, those first impressions turn out to be absolutely accurate, but because sometimes they're laced with seething rage and cynicism,
mm-hmm.
I don't act on them because I don't want to act out of this wellspring of evil that I know I have, but I don't use. You know what I'm saying? How do you get past that? I mean, if the instincts are right, mm-hmm. how do you not, you know, how do you use them without, you know, appearing to be very, very snap judgmental as opposed to ordinary judgment?
Yeah. Well, I think that there's a couple of answers to that. One is that there is no shame in reaching a decision very quickly if you're confident that you're reaching a decision in a fair way. Let me give you an example. I have a whole chapter in the book on auditions in classical music.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask someone who does auditions, they'll tell you they make up their mind about whether someone can play or not in about four or five notes right away. Boom. They know. They even know sometimes when they're warming up, right? Total snap judgment. Can you trust that? Well, the answer is sort of, because classical music went through this whole big shift about 20 years ago where they used to look at the person playing. And when they looked at the person playing, they only ever picked men.
Yeah, I know.
Then they put up screens so they couldn't see the person playing, and all of a sudden they started hiring women. Right? And what they realized was that their snap judgment of how well someone was playing was being polluted by the evidence of their eyes because they could see the person, and they had these kind of feelings about women that they didn't realize.
Like cultural sexism.
Yeah, exactly.
So now you were isolating a problem that was clouding the perception, and now they could just bring their informed snap judgment.
Exactly.
You sort of make a point of that snap judgments, a lot of times, especially if it is an informed snap judgment, like the art history story you talk about in about the statue. Maybe we'll get a little into that over the break. That people who make snap judgments who spend 30 years or 40 years playing classical music, it's probably a pretty good snap judgment if there isn't something clouding their perception. So you're saying to remove these obstacles would actually, you know, make people more honest and actually make the snap judgments in honoring them a more a good thing, a productive thing.
We can clean them up.
Okay.
And when we clean them up, I think they're really, really trustworthy.
That's interesting. So let's apply that to politics when we get back. Is that okay?
Sure.
We're talking to Malcolm Gladwell, the author of Blink, The Power of Thinking Without Thinking. We'll be back in a second. It's 45 past the hour.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
All right, we're going to try and put the craft down here. It's 49 past the hour. I am Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yes, it is.
We're talking to Malcolm Gladwell, the author of Blink, The Power of Thinking Without Thinking, which actually sounds like a self-help book, which it's not at all. It's an investigation into, impulse, reactions to things. And there's two questions I want to ask you as we lead into politics. First, how do you know to trust these impulses, these first flash moments of inside of genetic reaction almost to stimulus.
I think, well, one of the lessons of the book is that we need to be very wary of them, and we should only trust them when certain kind of conditions are met, when we have specific experience in that area.
Or so if it's within the context of your expertise, or you...
Then I'm more comfortable with, or when we've taken steps to do something to kind of clean up our first impressions, then I'm a lot more confident in them.
Which is, like, in terms of politics, is interesting, because they really sort of weigh candidates. They decide on candidates, not the public, but people who are running them, on people's snap judgment of them, their immediate judgment of them.
I tell a story in a book about Warren Harding, who's a great example of this. That, you know, a magnificent-looking man.
Yeah.
Easily our best-looking president ever. The voice, the chest, the grizzled, you know, the graying at the temples, the iron jaw. Mm-hmm. And he was just some local politician in Ohio, and he was spotted by the Karl Rove of his day.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy looked at him and said, "What a great-looking president you would make," you know. And he took him under his wing, and sure enough, Warren Harding rose through the ranks and was elected president, and he was a numbskull.
Right.
He didn't even want to be president. He just wanted to chase women, play cards, and drink with his buddies. And he got that far because he just fit everyone's image.
Well, you're talking first about impression.
Well, you know, it's funny because, you know, I thought of this, the Warren Harding chapter, and this is not a political book.
Yeah.
But it's kind of hard to read the Warren Harding chapter and not think about what's going on.
Well, there's
right
that great moment when Karl Rove fell in love with George Bush and decided that he would be the human representation of his own penis and go on to lead the free world. But the interesting thing about this is that when you have these impulses, when they find a charismatic guy, and then you have millions of dollars clouding the perception of the populace into trusting that impulse.
But Bush has got that for, you know, whatever you feel about him, he's got that thing that Warren Harding had.
For some people.
Not exactly the same. He's not that he's super handsome.
Right.
He does project some kind of image that a lot of people in this country find enormously comforting. And that intuition about him is wrong, I think, personally.
Yeah.
It's detached from the reality of the man. And that's why I think we have to be, we got to take this stuff really seriously. Because unless we interrogate it, it screws up our lives.
Okay.
We become prisoners of this incredibly powerful reaction that we have when we see this man who projects courage, and he projects integrity, and he projects commitment, and he projects all these things.
And he's also a guy that says he acts on these type of instincts, you know, regularly, because he believes that, you know, his context of experience is that God is talking to him.
Yeah.
And
they're
telling him that this impulse is from.
And both Colin Powell and George Bush had an instinct about the war in Iraq. And this is a classic example of what I talk about in my book. Colin Powell's instinct was, it's going to be a quagmire, right? I trust that instinct because that guy came through Vietnam. He'd been in the army his entire life. He has the kind of instinct we ought to care. Bush had an instinct that we would go there and they would greet us as victors and wave palm trees and we would be happy.
Mm-hmm.
Why would we trust that instinct? What's it based on? It's based on running the Texas Rangers.
It's also based on this is the weird thing about propaganda and about the millions of dollars that goes into exploiting exactly what you're talking about, is that the only other time you hear this type of thing talked about is in marketing rooms where people are designing marketing or rooms of advertising agencies where it's like, how do we get them to make that judgment that you're talking about and trust it immediately and make them follow that impulse. And that goes into selling politics and selling false realities. Mm-hmm. And then people grow to trust this false reality. But in your book, do you discuss that when you do trust a false impulse and follow it, is there a nag to it? Is there something eating at you that, you know, knows that there you've made some mistake?
You know, I wish. I really don't. You know, I came away from writing this book enormously impressed by the ability of people to fool themselves over the long run. I really believe that we can't have we can't make proper decisions as individuals or as a society unless we intervene in some way. We've got to put up the screen that I was talking about earlier.
You talk in your book about a number of people who are astonishingly accurate in predicting certain things, in making certain judgments based on this whole thinking without thinking.
Yeah.
Is there a common thread that runs through all of them aside from the, you know, the process?
Yeah. There are, to go back to the experience point, they are all people who have spend an enormous amount of time in their area of expertise, to the point where they have built up their unconscious knowledge so they can make a... And there are also people who have paid enormous attention to the context in which they make decisions. So I tell this, the story I tell at the beginning about the guy who can, that Thomas Hubbing used to head the Met, who can look at a piece of art and know instantly whether it was real or fake. He's someone who spent his, you know, he would tell, when he bought a new piece of art for the Met, he would tell his staff to hide it somewhere. Like, stick it in a drawer, or put it in a room and then turn the light off, and then turn the light on when I come into the room. Because he wanted to see that object, by accident. He didn't want to be thinking about it before he saw it. He wanted to be confronted with it, you know, just boom, and then have to think and see it objectively in that first moment. He was very, very concerned with setting the scene, in other words, for an effective snap judgment. And I really thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it's a fascinating part of the book. And if you want to know the rest of that story and some more stories that revolve around trusting or not trusting these instincts, it's a fascinating read. It's Blink, The Power of Thinking Without Thinking. Our guest has been Malcolm Gladwell. Thank you very much for joining us.
Appreciate it. It's really a lot of fun.
And there's our liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Please write down your marching orders for today, liberals. All right, one, now that Kid Rock's been dropped from Bush's inauguration, reclassify him from GOP hack to just hack. Two, if Angelina Jolie really did break up Brad Pitt's marriage by co-starring in a movie with him, make sure her next movie is with Bush and Carl Rove. Can we arrange that? Is there any way? Okay, three, cast Michael Powell to appear on live new version of This Old House so that when he accidentally hits his thumb with a hammer, he'll say and have to find himself. Go find yourself.
Yeah.
Hey, now that the search for the WMDs is over, send the White House this letter. Told ya, love Hans Blix. Five, phrase of the day, just drop it into conversation. Quote, you know why the trade deficit's at $60 billion last month? Because the only thing we manufacture in this country is excuses to kill Muslims. Wake up, sheeple. Bush took your rent money, man.
Oh, Lord.
Tomorrow, Sam Lipsyte.
Move over, Oprah. We got a morning sedition book club in the house tomorrow. Have a good one, Marin.
You too, buddy.
Mark Marin and Mark Riley. Morning Sedition.